Today is Monday, July 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Iran's Nuclear Energy Agency says the country has surpassed the limits on how much it was allowed to enrich uranium under the 2015 international nuclear deal.
Iran better be careful, because you enriched for one reason, and I won't tell you what that reason is.
Greece's opposition conservatives have returned to power with a landslide victory in snap elections, and dozens of powerful Afghans resume talks with the Taliban in Doha. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Iran's nuclear agency says the country has surpassed the limits on how much it was allowed to enrich uranium under the 2015 international deal. Iran said it passed 4.5% enrichment, breaching the 3.67% limit set in the accord aimed at restraining Tehran's nuclear weapons development. Iran said it could consider enriching uranium up to 20% as the next step in its move to back away from its commitments under the nuclear deal unless it gets the help it wants from the accord's other signatories to overcome the crippling effects of U.S. economic sanctions imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the pact last year. Uranium enriched to 5% is sufficient to produce fuel for nuclear power plants, but still far below the 90% needed for building a nuclear weapon. The United Nations Atomic Watchdog Agency said it was in the process of verifying the Iranian claim that it had breached the enrichment limit. Joining me on the phone is VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. Cindy, how are you?
Good, Steve. Pleasure to be with you.
So in response to Iran's claims, what has the Trump administration said as it says it has surpassed the 2015 limits?
Well, this has caused a great deal of alarm and concern, and we've had a number of top U.S. officials, including the president himself, coming out and saying on Sunday that warning Iran it better be careful, saying that Iran will never have a nuclear weapon without specifying exactly what actions might be taken. And on Monday, we've had Vice President Mike Pence during a speech saying that the U.S. does not seek war with Iran and is willing to talk still, but also saying that America will not back down on the nuclear issue. And over in Tehran, we've had an Army Chief Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi also saying that Iran is not looking for war with any country. So we've had tensions escalating even more with this. It's being seen as a very serious breach by Iran with this, increasing the quality of the nuclear material. And so but at the same time, we've had Vice President Pence saying that the U.S. is not seeking war.
What about the international community, as there were other signatories to that 2015 deal? Have they made any comments?
Yes, we've had the European Union with Germany and Britain and France signatories to the deal saying that they were extremely concerned about Iran to stop and reverse all the activities that are inconsistent with the deal. As you and listeners, I'm sure, know that the European Union is still very much believes in this deal, and this is a strong bone of contention between the U.S. and its traditional EU allies. We've also had reaction from Russia. Russia saying it's concerned about Iran's statement today and promise to, you know, increase the nuclear enrichment. But Russia also saying that blaming President Trump, saying his turning his back on the deal and putting all these sanctions on Iran has escalated the tensions and basically contributed to the situation.
Really briefly, we just have about 30 seconds left. Tensions in the region have been escalating, and Britain did seize an Iranian oil tanker off the coast of Gibraltar last week. Has Iran made any other statements about that situation?
Yes, Iran has again called on Britain to release that tanker and threatening that if it doesn't, that they would have to seize a British tanker. So a lot tension's very high on that front, Steve.
Cindy Sain is a State Department correspondent for The Voice of America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has condemned the conditions of detention in which refugees and migrants are being held on the southern border of the United States. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet calls conditions in these detention camps appalling for both adult and child refugees and migrants, but especially so for the children. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA the High Commissioner, as a former pediatrician and as a mother, grandmother, and former head of state, feels personally stricken by the plight of the children.
She's deeply shocked from all these perspectives at the way that children are being forced to sleep on the floor in overcrowded facilities without access to adequate health care or food, separated from their families in many circumstances, and with very poor sanitation conditions. And these are conditions that have been documented by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General itself.
Shamdasani says any deprivation of liberty for child and adult migrants should be a measure of last resort. She says the UN Rights Office is concerned about the U.S. government's management policy, which seems to be based on detecting, detaining, and deporting irregular migrants.
This is particularly egregious when, in the case of children, who in many cases are being separated from their families, being held in horrid detention conditions. The many different UN human rights bodies have found that the detention of migrant children may constitute cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which is, of course, prohibited by international law.
Shamdasani says children should never be held in immigration detention or separated from their families. She says doing so may cause irreparable harm to the child's development and well-being. Kevin McAleenan, the acting secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, maintained on Sunday that reports of unsanitary conditions and inadequate food and water are unsubstantiated. In a recent television interview, he said steps are being taken to improve the detention centers. Some members of the U.S. Congress are also calling for the improved treatment of migrants being held in U.S. custody. Migrant arrests by the U.S. Border Patrol this year have hit the highest level since 2007. In May alone, agents detained nearly 133,000 refugees and migrants, including more than 11,500 unaccompanied children. Shamdasani tells VOA migration is a very complex issue. She says the U.S., Mexico, and Central American countries have to work together to address the root causes compelling migrants to leave their homes. She adds this needs to be done in a way that puts the human rights of the migrants front and center of any policies that are adopted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also brought up the issue of human rights Monday when announcing a new commission on the topic.
The commission is composed of human rights experts, philosophers, and activists, Republicans, Democrats, and independents of varied backgrounds and beliefs, who will provide me with advice on human rights grounded in our nation's founding principles and the principles of 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Professor Marianne Glendon will chair the commission, whose focus, as she states, is on principle, not policy. Among other top stories in the world, Britain was scrambling Monday to find the source of a leak of diplomatic cables from Washington that described U.S. President Donald Trump as inept, insecure, and incompetent. The blaze on board a nuclear-powered Russian deep-diving submersible that killed 14 elite crewmen last week has come to light on Russia's top-secret underwater intelligence service, as well as its growing focus on the research-rich polar region. Afghan authorities say they have arrested four Islamic State operatives, including a university teacher, during a counterterrorism raid in Kabul. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and with our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of researchers from the University of South Florida, Florida Atlantic University, and Georgia Institute of Technology say they have discovered the biggest bloom of seaweed in the world during the summer of 2018. The seaweed itself is a form of brown macroalgae called sargassum, and this giant seaweed bloom is called the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt. It was estimated to weigh about 20 million tons and covered parts of the surface of the Atlantic Ocean from West Africa to the Gulf of Mexico. To make their discovery, the researchers say they analyzed data gathered by NASA's Terra satellite. By studying environmental and field-gathered data, the researchers also determined that the giant seaweed belt forms seasonally and as a response to an input of natural and human-produced nutrients into the ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Dozens of powerful Afghans resumed talks with the Taliban today in Doha, where a possible ceasefire is on the table, along with key issues such as women's rights. Stakes are high for the talks, which follow a week of U.S.-Taliban negotiations, with both sides eyeing a resolution to the bloody 18-year-old conflict. Washington has said it wants to seal a political deal with the Taliban ahead of Afghan presidential polls due in September to allow foreign forces to begin to withdraw. Greece's opposition conservatives returned to power with a landslide victory in snap elections. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says he had a clear mandate for change, pledging more investments and fewer taxes. Now, for more on the election's results and what it means for Greece's future, I spoke with Athens-based reporter Aris Estepalopoulos. I began our conversation by asking him if the results were all that surprising.
Well, Steve, everybody knew that Mitsotakis would win the elections by 8 to 10%. And as it turned out, it was 8.32%. But what was really surprising was that 31.53, I think, percent of the voters still trusted Syriza by voting for them. So now we're talking about, let me check my numbers here. We're talking about 152 parliament members for Mitsotakis, 86 for Tsipras, and the rest, 56 seats, are shared by four parties. So everybody knew Mitsotakis would win, but nobody expected that Syriza would perform that well. But also, I would like to mention the turnout of the elections, which reached a record-breaking 42%. Another surprising thing was that Golden Dawn, the far-right Greek party, crashed out of the parliament. And that was really surprising as well, because it used to be the third party. I mean, it was their popularity was getting bigger and bigger.
So what does this all mean for Greece moving forward? I mean, you have Mitsotakis as the prime minister. You still have Tsipras's party with a significant amount of seats. How do things move forward?
Well, first of all, Mitsotakis has to handle, he has many challenges. And the first bills that he wants to pass are about, of course, economy, and they all have to do with money. So he has promised a reduced VAT for food and social services, to reduce a single property tax, which is a big pain point in Greece. He wants to focus on external investments because it is a capitalist party, and, of course, they want to get the attention of external investors. He wants to help businesses with lower taxes and lower contributions. Of course, he has promised to reduce unemployment rates. And now there are in Greece like 850,000 unemployed people. He wants to reduce the number to 500,000 unemployed people. And right now, the growth rate in the country, it's 2%, and Mitsotakis plans to bump it up to 4%, which is a really, really challenging task. And of course, everybody wants to see how he's going to handle the conflicts between Greece and our neighbor country, Turkey.
So what does that mean for politics in Greece moving forward? I mean, we now have a return to a more mainline conservative ruling power in Athens. We've seen the shift all over Europe with more populist-type parties gaining power. What's the future of Greek politics?
First of all, Mitsotakis, I think one of the reasons he got elected was that he changed the way people see his party. New Democracy always was kind of conservative, and they always focused on economics and on the economy and not on social issues. And right now, what he did was he kind of modernized the party, and it made it more approachable. There are some plans about the about social issues and not only finances. But at the same time, yeah, I believe that all eyes are on Griezmann right now, and it makes complete sense because everybody wants to see how shifting from a populist to a conservative capitalist government is going to work.
That was Athens-based reporter Aris Apostolopoulos. Tens of thousands of protesters marched on Sunday to raise awareness among mainland Chinese visitors about the political crisis that has rocked Hong Kong before a smaller group clashed with police. Hong Kong police arrested six individuals after the protests, which occurred in one of the city's biggest tourist areas, Tsim Sha Tsui. For the latest on the ongoing protests in Hong Kong, I spoke with local journalist Shermaine Lee. I began our conversation by having her describe the protests on Sunday.
They actually marched to West Kowloon Station, and the demonstrators were trying to spread the message of anti-extradition to the mainland tourists, and that's why they picked the spot. And it was quite unique because it was the biggest protest on the Kowloon side of Hong Kong. And that's why I think some of the slogans were chanted in Mandarin yesterday instead of the usual Cantonese that were seen in the previous protests.
What kind of slogans were chanted in Mandarin?
So they reiterated the five demands. So the first one is definitely the most urgent one, is a complete withdrawal of the bill. And they also want the government to recall the categorization of riots. And also they want the police to drop the charges of the protesters and investigate on police brutality. And this time they also add a new demand. So before that, they would ask Carrie Lam to step down, but they changed that now to universal suffrage.
So after the protests during the day on Sunday, there were more protesters who stayed around in the area into the evening and then clashed with police. Can you describe what took place?
I was at the protest till around around 8 or 9. So I have seen a rising tension between the protesters and the police. So I've seen a lot of protesters shouting insults at the police, and the police are trying to not do anything about it. But I think at midnight, it escalated to another level. There was definitely some clashes between the two groups that resulted in the arrest of six people at the end.
Do we know more about the charges being levied against them?
Some of them are about attacking police officers, and some are failing to show their identity documents.
We've been talking about these protests in Hong Kong for over a month now. They culminated, so to speak, with the break-in at the legislative complex last week. Where do these protests seem to be headed, especially since we are now seeing police making arrests, not only with the legislative complex break-in, but also with Sunday's protests?
Well, I've seen netizens organizing more protests this month. So there are 18 districts in Hong Kong, so the netizens are trying to have a new campaign of spreading this anti-extradition law in all the 18 districts. So they're organizing two new protests in the next two Sundays.
And that was Hong Kong-based journalist Shermaine Lee. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
This just in. All of July, Border Crossings is having a very special CD giveaway. If you're looking to listen to the top songs of the summer, we've got the CD for you. Every weekday, we'll be giving away Now That's What I Call Hits and Remixes 2019.
Hooray!
The CD presents an 18-track lineup of this year's top singles and remixes to date. You'll have access to the hottest artists of the summer, including Taylor Swift.
Are you ready for it?
Marshmello and Selena Gomez.
I've been running through the jungle, I've been running with the wolves to get to you.
Shawn Mendes.
There's nothing holding me back.
Maroon 5.
Can you turn around? Can you turn around? Just wait.
And so many more. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time all of July to be able to listen to the top hits all summer long.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Australia is closely tracking a high-tech Chinese spy ship that is believed to be on its way to monitor war games off the Queensland coast. Phil Mercer reports Australian defense officials suspect the ship will try to gather information as multinational military drills begin.
The Chinese ship is fitted with advanced communication systems to eavesdrop on other forces. The AGI, or Auxiliary General Intelligence Vessel, was thought to be north of Papua New Guinea, Australia's nearest neighbour, over the weekend, on a journey that's expected to end off the coast of Queensland. It's thought the ship will closely monitor huge joint military exercises from just outside Australian territory. For the first time, Japanese forces are involved in military drills in Australian waters with the United States. Experts believe the Chinese have particular interest in the Japanese Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade and how it operates with its US and Australian counterparts. It was formed last year, partly in response to tensions in the East China Sea. Japan has control of the uninhabited Senkaku Islands, although Beijing also claims them under another name. Lieutenant General Greg Bilton, the Chief of Defence Joint Operations, says Australia will keep a close watch of the movement of the Chinese surveillance vessel.
In regards to the AGI, we believe there is one north of Australia at the moment. We're tracking it. We don't know yet what its destination is, but we're assuming that it will come down to the east coast of Queensland, and we'll take appropriate measures in regards to that. It is international waters. They have the right to sail there. I'm not going to go into operational details, but we'll just take appropriate actions in regards to that. It's a vessel that collects information, so it's not a great threat, but we'll take appropriate action.
Analysts believe the presence of the Chinese ship highlights a double standard from the superpower. They believe that while China will be exercising its rights under a United Nations convention to monitor the war games in international waters, it often forces foreign ships out of its self-declared military alert zones. Up to 25,000 military personnel from the United States and Australia, as well as Canada, New Zealand and Japan, are taking part in Exercise Talisman Sabre that runs until August. They're held every 2 years. In 2017, a Chinese surveillance ship was spotted off eastern Australia during the manoeuvres. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The International Criminal Court has found former Congolese rebel leader Bosco Ntaganda guilty Monday of all 18 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Ntaganda had denied being a killer and a war criminal when he spoke at his trial in The Hague Thursday. Ntaganda insisted he was a soldier, not a criminal. He said, "I have never attacked civilians. I have always protected them." A lawyer for the victims told the court that girls as young as 12 were forced to serve as so-called wives to senior rebel commanders. And before I go, we'll take a quick look back in time. It was on this date in 1947, a New Mexico newspaper, the Roswell Daily Record, quoted officials at Roswell Army Airfield as saying that they had recovered a flying saucer that crashed onto a ranch. Officials then said it was actually a weather balloon. To this day, there are those who believe what fell to Earth was an alien spaceship carrying extraterrestrial beings. And in 1911, cowgirl Tugun Nan Aspinwall became the first woman to make a solo trip by horse across the United States, arriving in New York 10 months after departing San Francisco. And finally, in 1947, demolition work began in New York City to make way for the new permanent headquarters of the United Nations. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, engineer Joe Gill, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. Now, if you'd like to have pictures, videos, stories, and a whole lot more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, if you have a mobile device, download our app. That way you can take our stories with you anytime. That's going to do it for me. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.